Welcome to the Board of Education, where troublemakers and system breakers gather to discuss how they are dismantling inequity in public education. Calling our meeting to order, Chairman of the Board, Jonathan Santos Silva.
That's right. I'm Jonathan Santos Silva. He is Doc Miller, and this is the Board of Ed. I hope y'all didn't think we were going to leave y'all like that. We had a dope finale, but, you know, we're a little extra over here. We had to save something. I just love the idea of having a bonus episode. What do you think, Doc?
I'm still recovering from the finale. What people didn't get to hear is the freestyle that Anishe Wright did, which I may or may not have recorded, but she definitely freestyled to our theme song. Just another layer of her brilliance. And we have another brilliant leader on the board today for this very special bonus episode.
I think the first thing I want to say is we may need to do like a Patreon. If you want to hear a freestyle, we might have to set up a Patreon so you can join and contribute. And we have so much great bonus content. So, you know, that might be a season two innovation. But second of all, yes, we do have an amazing, amazing board member. I love all our board members, but Carla and I go pretty far back. We've worked together in more than one organization. She's amazing. She is, I think, the modern powerhouse, right? She's a mom. She's a life partner to an awesome, awesome brother in the work. And she's the leader of a phenomenal, I would say still new, but like not new organization, you know, because they've been on the scene doing amazing work. Carla Vigil, Chief Executive Officer of the Equity Institute. What's up, Carla?
What's up? What's up, everybody? How are you?
I'm great. It's good to see you. You know,
you too.
We have the, you know, it's Zoom. I imagine one day I could like record episodes in person and sit across from people, but it's great to see you even on Zoom. We are living in crazy times. And I don't think that's like, I'm not going out on a shaky limb there. You know, before we went on record, you know, you and I were chatting and you said how, you know, we're living through two different pandemics. We've got like the virus pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic, which has killed over 200,000 Americans and counting, countless other people worldwide. And then we also have a pandemic of structural systemic racism and oppression, which has killed many millions of people here in this country and abroad. And both of them, we are like at this powerful intersection where people are primarily stuck at their homes, they're out of their routine, and we've had an unprecedented opportunity to reflect. And I just was wondering, as like CEO of like, I mean, how it couldn't be more apropos, an organization called the Equity Institute, how would you lay out the case for what we're going through right now and what's needed, not just in education, but for us as a people, as an American people, to like heal and chart a course? Like what's the need? What's the issue right now as you see it?
Yeah, I think that's a really great and deep question. You know, when COVID first hit earlier this year, it changed, right? Everybody's lives, like everybody's life was disrupted in so many ways. And I think that disruption is still going on. As an organization running, you know, work that's rooted in equity and racial justice, one of the things that we did was pause to really reflect and think about the work that we were doing.
I remember that.
And I think that in a society where we really operate from a very white supremacy culture, we are automatically wanting to produce and produce and produce and just weather through anything. And I think that this pandemic has really taught all people from all different places, it's not possible and it's not sustainable. There's been several reports and research that have come out recently where people are really stressed. There's high level of anxiety, not only in adults, but in children as well. And it's because you know, we don't have the normal lives that we've had and we probably will never have. And we haven't even stopped to recognize what that means in terms of moving forward in all the work we do. And that's, you know, that applies in on a personal and professional level. So what we've done is not only pause, but we've had to pause at several different moments. Because we've had to deal with different things, right? We run an organization, but we also have kids who were learning virtually. And so that meant that they had to stick with us while we were in the office, you know, facilitating trainings or having meetings. And we still do. And it's still, you know, we're still waiting for, like, you know, the normal lives to come back, where we're sending kids to school, where we have a routine. And like I said earlier, the truth is, I don't think that's coming back. And so pausing at several moments has been something that's helped us, but it's not something that has contributed for us to heal as a collective group of people in an org or in our community. Equity Institute focuses on building community, uniting people, and supporting teachers, specifically teachers of color. And that's been a real struggle. I have been on the phone with several teachers who have, you know, cried on the phone because of the level of stress that they have and because they're scared. They are scared. Not only are they scared for, you know, their health, but more importantly, the health of their students, you know, and not only the health of the students, the idea that somebody might pass away if they contract the virus, right? It's something that no teacher wants to ever live with, right? And so they're not only dealing with that, but they're dealing with other barriers, like, you know, not really having 6 feet distance apart in their classroom because they don't have the space, right? So we're operating from a place of especially, you know, in our core city, Providence, in a place where we were already lacking resources. And so it's hard to create new systems that can provide those needs when there's those resources, right? Like the buildings are old and so you can feel the stress level of teachers right now. And like I said, dealing with COVID has adds a whole nother layer. Yeah, absolutely.
You said more than a mouthful. I mean, I'm thinking there's so many connections. One, I'm thinking about Dr. Dara Tonema, who we spoke to earlier this season, who talked about the anxiety and the stress that his son experienced whenever he had to leave. Because, you know, I think his son, eighth grade or eight years old? I forget, but he was trying to process the pandemic. It's dangerous. We got to wear masks. We got to stay inside. But then my dad's leaving. Like, are you going to come back? Right. And so there's a lot of stress with that. You know, I'm thinking about just this week, yesterday, my wife says, "You remember so-and-so? You had him, right?" And I'm like, "What happened?" And one of my former students died. And I'm 37 years old. I've experienced loss. It kicked me right, you know, kicked the feet out from under me. But I also have, you know, this perspective to, like, you know, pivot and be like, you know, think about his family, think about the community. You know, what are the ways we can, you know, support people who are going to struggle with this worse than me? But I'm like, well, what about the kids? It is undeniable that there are students who will go if we go back, or even if they go on video, they're going to return to classrooms that are missing kids, that are missing teachers, people they care about and love and have a relationship with. That's a lot. That is a lot on a well-adjusted, or relatively, you know, my wife may have a different take on it, on a relatively well-adjusted grown-up. Think about what it does for our kids who are just trying to make it.
That's right. I mean, in the moment that we're living now is chaotic. It's challenging to say the least, but the whole world is. And it's like this wave of energy that everybody's feeling. And it's not just you know, one group of people. It's literally everybody. Now, I mean, I could say, like, you know, when you have more access to resources and more money, it's a little bit different, right? And we can see that with what has played out with our government, you know, if you know what I mean. But I would say also, I personally, we just went through a COVID experience and my whole family got COVID. Mm. And I can't express the level of mental exhaustion that exists when, you know, dealing with this. I had no space to think of anything else but cleaning, wiping things down, making sure my family was okay. Now, thankfully, they were asymptomatic for the most part. There were some folks in my family who were not, but we definitely Kate became part of the, you know, COVID statistics in terms of we let our guards down and got together and were together for a family get together, and everybody got COVID, you know. And like I said, luckily we were okay, but like, this is the time that we live in, and it is not sustainable nor possible that schools are going to be reopening and children are not going to get COVID. I'm watching in my own state, there are cases popping up in all different schools and classrooms that need to shut down because of it. So I say that all because I think it's important as we think about, you know, the future of where we're going and the future of supporting our community. We have a lot of reimagining to do, but also I think a lot of investment in holding our leaders accountable to provide the new systems that we need, because if not, we're just going to go back to the way that things were.
You know, you alluded to it earlier, right? Like how it's hard to imagine or to plot, right? Like the rebound, right? When we know how many resources, how much marshalling of focus and attention it will require, when in communities like Providence and many other communities, just to be fair, right? It's not a dog on Providence necessarily, although there's enough responsibility and accountability to go around. Like there were issues and there was lack before COVID hit, right? Like for those who may or may not know, what is it? Are we about a year and some change out from the Johns Hopkins report?
About a year and some change.
Right. Yep. So that basically revealed, well, for some folks it revealed, for the parents, for the young people, for the folks working in the buildings, this wasn't a revelation. It revealed though to the broader public that a number of the school buildings, the facilities that we were sending our kids to every day, and I say we because I was living in Providence at the time, we're sending our kids to, were unsafe, that had pest infestations, asbestos, crumbling facades and things like that that were putting kids at risk. I remember prior to working with Carla, I had coach teachers, some of whom worked in Providence. And I remember one time going to visit preparing to visit one of my teachers. And he said, you probably shouldn't visit this week. And I'm like, why, what's up? He's like, we're not really in a classroom right now. I said, well, where are you at? He said, we're in the hallway. I said, why are you in the hallway? He said, well, because a tile fell and there's asbestos in our ceiling. So the classroom was in the hallway. And so like, you know, this report comes out and all the politicians want to like pretend, you know, they all, you know, won Academy Awards for being like, how could this be? But like parents knew, kids knew, teachers knew. And so now you throw on top of a community that has, in fairness, started to turn and pivot and marshal resources. And now you go, oh, and by the way, now you got to put kids 6 feet away from each other. Now you got to have PPE. Now you got to have this and that. And again, like this is not just Providence. This is all over the place.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I was part of that that report observer, an evaluator who went into the schools. And I'll tell you that the first day that I visited a school in one of my old neighborhoods, I left, like I had to sit down and I was just in tears. And I was in tears because, you know, when I identify as a Latina, you know, I was born in El Salvador. I came here in 1983. And I don't know if you know, but, you know, in Providence, about 66% of the students are identify as Latino or Latina, and 91% are students of color. So going into the school, it touched me in a different way, right? Because I was watching kids that look like me, that represent a lot of similar cultural behaviors and attitudes, and the condition of the school, the practices that I witnessed in the classrooms, the tones of the teacher to the students. This was their reality every single day, you know, and the damage that it does early on. They were babies. This was an elementary school, and it broke my heart. And having three boys and having one who's 3 years old right now, and you know, thinking about his education and it kind of like the lens that I have at this age with all my experience, I would never, ever want my child to be in that toxic environment. Right. And this is not to shame or judge teachers either, because I think this is bigger than that. And it's systemic again, like
way bigger. Yep.
So it's, you know, they're frustrated and tired. And so I don't say that to, you know, disparage teachers or the leaders, because I think it's bigger than that. But I do say that because the truth of the matter is our kids are being hurt and harmed, and it's a cycle. And so as I am here, you know, talking to you as a 40-year-old woman, I've had to break so many cycles. And for me, I think about their future already. And I think about where are they going to be, you know, 15 years from now, if we don't do anything, you know. And it's hard to break that cycle when you don't have the resources, when you don't have the opportunities, you know, or nobody's there to tap into that potential. And it leads me to, you know, really think about, you know, our approach that we use at EI in terms of preparing teachers and giving them that lens to be culturally responsive, to be equitable, to be anti-racist, right? And so even though we don't, in our district, we have about 87, 88% white teachers, like if we're teaching from that lens, then we do a little magic for our kids. We start to change something. We start to spark something in them, because because you can identify, you know, you can acknowledge those differences. But when you have a district that's all, 88% white teachers that have been teaching from 20 years ago and have had maybe an outdated teacher prep program, right? We're perpetuating harm there. Mm-hmm. And perpetuating inequities. And so even though we're going through COVID right now, and yes, those conditions were horrible. That was one school, right? I was already, you know, crying and exhausted. I actually had like a small breakdown at the end of that week. And so we're now facing another huge inequity, which is trying to provide an education, a quality education for our school children during COVID. And it's almost, right, impossible. And so you almost have this feeling of hopelessness. So when we talk about, you know, the future, do we still need teachers of color? Absolutely. Do we still need teachers? Absolutely. But how will teaching change? And, yes. and we're seeing now, you know, districts desperately looking for substitutes. You're seeing people who are starting to, districts and that are starting to, you know, provide incentives for you to become a substitute teacher. Yep. And so we might have to just change the way we teach, right? And change who teaches and who we put in front of our students, especially with, all these virtual like academies that are popping up now and providing services for students and districts. It's gonna change. And I think that, you know, we definitely need to be there to have a voice in how things change for the state of education.
I just want to touch on a couple of things that you hit on. Number one, you can tell how important this stuff is to you, that you're living it, because like everything you're saying is building blocks one after another. And I can attest, because I see you, you're not reading something. This is what you're really about. This is the work that the Equity Institute is doing day in and day out. This is the work that you promote through Edu Leaders, RI, connecting people to people, people to resources, you know, so this is it's the real deal. I appreciate that. Second thing I want to comment on is, like, you know, when I was young coming up, 40 was mad old.
For real.
It was mad old. And he's like, I'm 40. And I'm thinking, this is 40? Dang old.
He's running. Wait a minute. Sorry.
No, I said when I was a kid.
From
when
the producer's kid. Booth, the 40-year-old weighs in. Now, like, this has been hitting for me on all cylinders this whole time. And then you guys talk about old at 40.
No, I said, when I was a kid.
You thought it was old.
I thought it was old.
I think it's old.
But I'm looking at you. Hurts, like. Yeah. Trust me. I know what that's like, waking up and being like, I didn't do anything yesterday. Why am I sore? So things have changed. But what my point in that and bringing that up is, you said you're 40.
Yep.
You've been in the game for a minute. You're running the Equity Institute. You got Edu Leaders RI. You're doing the mom thing. You got a son in college. You got another one in what, middle school? Or is he in high school yet?
He's ninth grade.
Toddler. And then the 3-year. So it's like 40 ain't that old, right? It's still vital, energy, vibrant. And so I'm just impressed. And I'm just like, the next 3 years, you know, I got to set my game up because 40's coming for me. So I want to be as fly, as on point at 40 as you are.
Oh man, I don't know about that. Let me tell you something, Jonathan. You know, we're not going to talk about that, but it does have to, it definitely has to do with being, you know, when we talk about leaders and teachers of color or BIPOC, whatever term you feels closest to you. You know, I started late in the game, you know, and there are many reasons why I did. You know, I said I have a 20-year-old I had in my 19, you know, and when I talk about cycles, my mom had me at 15. So when we talk about breaking cycles, I feel like that's exactly what I'm doing, right? Is breaking cycles. And so it's not even responsibility. It is part of my purpose, my being, to use my privilege and my platform and my power now, the little that I got, you know, to create changes in my community, to create changes for other people. So when when I lead this org, I lead it with nothing but a wanting to disrupt everything. So yes. Even when I get advice from like your traditional, you know, quote unquote expert, I'm like, I'm going to challenge that thought because I think that we operate from this very, like I said, white supremacy culture. And we do that in so many ways. So it is my responsibility or purpose, like I mentioned, to change everything that I do, everything. I'm 40 and you know, I didn't know anything about retirement or anything like that when I was in my 20s. I wish I did, you know. So you know, yeah, I'm 40 and I'm doing all these things, but it just happened. It literally just happened. And we know that, you know, there's like so many like other barriers. We start late in the game. It's like, you know, the opportunity race that Kimberly Crenshaw shows in her speeches, and I think it was made by her org or work that she does. It's like, which I'm just like running. I'm like trying to run and I can't exactly catch up to my like white counterparts, but I'm still running. And I felt like that all my life, even when I was in college and I was like the only Latina in a marketing class, right? Or in my group and I was doing the work. It was like, I was always competing and running. And that's how I feel now. And I just, you said 40 and you said all those beautiful things and thank you so much. And yes, I am proud of the things that we've accomplished, but I'm still running, you know, I'm still running and trying to run in this game of leading and in this game of changing. And I recently just heard this you know, this quote that was beautiful because it reminded me about, like, you know, when you stop sometimes and you're like, wait, why do I do this work? Like this work is gonna run me down. Like, you know, but it's by James Baldwin. And he said, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's faced. And it just it reminded me, like, you know what? I may not be able to change everything that I want and everything that needs to be changed, but it again, it's my purpose to face it, you right? So I have to face like those injustices that need to be faced. I have to be a voice. I have to use my platform, my power, and my privilege to move the change, to push it, right? In whatever possible way that I can. However, I do believe that mental health and trauma healing is critical to this work. And so I really have promised myself to spend more time in doing that, you know, because y'all don't know me personally, but I like to hug trees and talk to the clouds and the moon. Like, that's the kind of person I am. Like, I am connected to everything around me. I'm a spiritual person, and I believe in those things. And I would rather spend time with nature than you know, people. I need to connect to the earth. The earth means a lot, you know, to me. I'm a big believer in you know, emergent strategy and Adrienne Marie Brown's work. You know, I love her work, Jonathan. And I do believe
I was gonna grab it because I had it on my desk.
I mean, I'm feeling it when, you know, like when you take like your ecosystem, nature, and you watch the changes in different ecosystems within nature to apply to yourself and your work for liberation. You know, I do believe in that. And so I try to practice it as much as I can, you know, being water changes constant. And so being able to like be flexible and not be tied to time and all these constraints that we put on ourselves, that really does take a toll on our mental health and our physical health as well. I'm not trying to die that early, you know, like I'm trying to live and I'm trying to enjoy things and breathe, you know, air in different time zones around the world. You know, I want to be able to love, you know, and I think like you've talked about this a lot, Jonathan, like you've talked about, you know, the power of love. And I think sometimes we forget and it's so needed, especially right now in this moment. Mm-hmm. In order to like take care of ourselves and each other.
There is so much that has come out of our episodes, and Carly, you were just like this is like the cherry on the absolute top is the idea of how do you boldly move toward the things that we need to change in a way that you're still able to care for yourself. Thinking through it from a teacher's lens, I think we are seeing a lot where teachers are going to be the frontline soldiers of the work of equity, right? It's going to be about increasing the diversity of the teacher workforce. So there are more teachers out there whose identities intersect with our kids so that they have teachers who look and sound and remind them of themselves. And there are a lot of white teachers out there who are working in schools that are serving diverse populations. And I think a question that I have, I get a lot, is how do you walk boldly into that space while managing all of the things that a teacher has to do? In other words, how does a teacher take an active role in being that leader for equity, especially in a place where maybe it's not being led from the top?
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, teaching is one of the most difficult jobs ever. I've done it. I remember it's like you have 28 different bodies with personalities, with interests, with cultural backgrounds, with so many identities. Teaching to me is an art and a science combined, right? Like you have to know your what you believe in, your philosophy. You have to know the pedagogies, but there's an art with it. So there are things that you can't possibly teach because it's also who you are as an individual that comes out. That's a natural thing. What I can say is the first thing that a teacher needs to do that's critical is really, really understand who they are. If you're not right in yourself, you're not gonna be right with students. And so that work has to be done. Now, I'm not saying that work is going to be done like in a month, in a year, in 2 years, but it has to be constant, right? That reflection piece for a teacher. And you have to know your own identity. You have to go back and understand and go back to the root. At our organization, everything we do comes from, it's a root cause. What's the root cause analysis of this? What's the why behind this? Let's dig into that. When we talk about, you know, our trainings, we do historical context or political education. We talk about the history. We talk about why are we here today? If you don't know that, then you can't possibly make a good decision in your classroom. Yep. You can't possibly understand what policies and what legislations and what systems have already oppressed the kids that are right in front of you. And perhaps yourself, if like you're white, has served you in a positive way, right? We've all been socialized to think a certain way. We've all internalized different things. It's just part of like the society that we live in. And this is not to make you feel bad or attack your character, right? This is to become aware. So that awareness is critical. And that is the first place you need to start. When I started teaching, that's where I started. I looked at the timeline of history. And when you look at it, you're like, whoa, this is deep. This is very deep. No wonder where we are today. You know, there was tons of articles that and writings that came out where it's like, you know, for the Brown versus Board of Education, 50 years later, we were still being segregated. We're still at very similar places that we were at, you know, 50, 60 now years ago. And so again, there's a reason for that. And so if teachers can't come to terms with that or understand that, it's going to be really hard for you to lead with equity. It's almost like impossible, right? So knowing the why, and then once you know that why, all the other practices kind of fit into place, and you can start using different tools that you need in order to help connect with your students, right? Culturally competent, culturally responsive, culturally proficient, you call it what you want. Like there's so many different terms, right? But it's really about understanding differences in individuals. That's really what it's about. You know, let's take the label away and let's just humanize it and say, okay, and it applies not just in the education space. It applies in any space, whether you work at a bank, whether you work at an investing firm. It's about understanding people and knowing that people are different. And what does that mean? It means they have different cultures, different sets of values, different sets of beliefs. And some of those sets of values and beliefs and attitudes are rooted in socialization, right? For example, you know, when somebody's pregnant, you're always like, are you having a girl or a boy? You know, parents tend to just pick blue or green. And those are things that we've been socialized to think, right? That this is binary. And as you know now, it's not. And it probably has never been, right? But in our culture, that's what we're taught. And so how do you unlearn those things in order to connect and build relationships with people? And you don't necessarily have to agree with it. However, as a teacher, you have to make sure that you're providing that student with safety, with acceptance, with inclusion. That is your role. You don't even have to love the child. I mean, I would love all my students, but you don't have to love them all. But they are your responsibility, and you're building community. And so part of it is like, how do you connect with your students to build that safe community where they feel like they could be themselves and learn and advocate for themselves, right? And say things like, this is not making me feel comfortable right now. And those are skills that you teach students. And I've seen it happen like in independent schools. I've not seen it happen in public schools, and you can see the difference. And there was a piece that, let me see, John Onion wrote called Social Class and the Hidden Curriculum of Work. And what she did, and this was conducted in the 1980s, and it's still relevant, but she researched different schools based on their social economic background. And what she found was, is not going to be surprising, right? It's that the lower income schools were basically being taught how to just become laborers and listen to rules and memorize content. And then you had the higher upper class folk students who were provided space for voice, who were writing petitions when they didn't like something in the school, who were thinking critically about the content, who were debating teachers or questioning their decisions. And so that is what you see today, you know, in terms of like our society of folks who have more access and more money and those who don't.
I wonder, this, we've entered into the interactive portion of this episode, because while I listened to every word that Carla said, you said something earlier, I don't know if you meant to or not. And it in that moment, I had this really quick thought of going, wait a minute, she said, it's clearly ingrained into my mind. You said, people ask parents if they're having a boy or a girl and they pick blue or green. And I went, no, I think she meant pink. I think she meant pink. And it's like, that is so ingrained in my mind that it triggered my brain. And I'm wondering if anybody else experienced that, because I'm like, whether you intended to or not, that was a pretty powerful point, because I was like, hold on. You conflicted one of my biases because you forgot pink. And but all of that stuff is absolutely like that.
Yeah, did that on purpose. That was a test, Doc. That was a test.
I thought so.
Yep. I was trying to.
She's brilliant.
But yes. But it proves the point. And number two, I think the really powerful thing here, and Jonathan, we've talked about this before, is, you know, I don't know that there is a quote unquote disposition of a teacher, but the work that Carla just laid out should be required, right? Like that's the foundational work. Don't grab a copy of Teach Like a Champion. Don't grab a copy of Marzano or anything like that. Grab a mirror, right? And look at your identity and do that exploration first. Because if you don't know you, you're not going to be able to authentically connect with kids.
Doc, you're so funny. Teach Like a Champion. When I was teaching at this school, which was a charter school called Blackstone Valley Prep in Rhode Island, they gave us Teach Like a Champion. And I was like, I opened the page and it was like, number 30, whatever, clap your hands three times or something like that. I was like, I am not doing this. And I remember asking, my mentor, and I was like, get that book away from me. I remember asking my mentor, like, hey, you know, they gave me this book, Teach Like a Champion. And he was like, what? I throw that book on the stage whenever, you know, in front of people, like saying like, this is garbage. You know, it works for some people. I knew, you know, my own intuition told me as a teacher right early on when they gave me that book, I was like, do not give me a book that tells me when to clap, how to snap, or how to do anything like that. That we're not training, you know,
seals,
animals. Like, what the heck? No. Like, and so at my school, they, you know, they had all these like tricks and dances and things like that. So I always like, you know, tweaked it and then did my own little you know, edit of it, you know, like, what's it called?
Variation or.
Thank you. Variation. Yeah. Exactly. And my kids loved it, you know, and I did it based on who they were after I knew after I did some, you know, relationship building after the first 6 weeks. Right. Yeah. I wasn't going to use, you know, a little cherry song like that they did. It is not part of who we are. So my point, I don't like Teach Like a Champion.
Yeah. You know, that's one of those things that's a polarizing topic. I know, particularly given recent context, but also historically, it's been sort of a thing. I happen to have the opportunity to contribute to another podcast, Eight Black Hands.
Are you cheating on me with another podcast?
No, it was like.
Yeah.
Oh, Jonathan's mad at me. I'm gonna have to send him flowers. but. That same question came up, and the gentleman on that episode talked about it in a slightly different way. They said, like, there are some tools in there that you can use effectively, it's how you use it. And this analogy came up of, you know, a hammer is not a bad tool or a good tool, but a hammer can build a house or tear it down. And so I live in this space of where do we find the tools and which ones need to be thrown out because they're systemically wrong. They're designed from the ground up to as tools that don't do the job, or which tools can be reused or repurposed to actually even the playing field.
And I'll take that analogy. I didn't see the episode or listen to it, so I don't know where they were going, but like, isn't it often also said, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I think that's the issue I have with Teach Like a Champion. When you give it to someone who hasn't done the work, Carla, that you're talking about, the self-work, the ability to learn who your kids are, build relationship and understand who they are, what they need. And all you have is claps and snaps and songs. Then that's like every kid, every issue in class becomes a nail. And then you don't have a diversity of tools to meet the moment. It's just up, bang, yep, right. Snap, clap, yeah. You know?
So yeah, I see that point, Doc, you know, and I know, like, I know 8 Black Hands and I know the folks that lead it, and they're great and they do great work, you know. I do think, like, you know, charter schools definitely have, it's almost like they make up this formula on how to teach. And so you have a lot of young white teachers that come out and they're like, here, take this book and learn these things. Now, are there things in there that you could use? Sure, probably. You know, everything's about a balance, you know, but are you going to use, like, what's the point of giving a book like that? I think there's so many other ways of doing it. Again, teaching is an art. And I think that's the problem with our teaching force now, is that we put them through this like very fast program and then we give them a book and they learn these tricks, right? And there's nothing wrong with learning tricks and having tricks in your bag, but are those tricks valuable, right? Like, and how is it being culturally responsive? Again, is that being culturally responsive? Right? Is that being equitable, using some of those little tricks in your bag? So I think like those are questions that you need to ask yourself, because I'm sure I could look at the, you know, read the book and find one or two things that I'm like, all right, this is not that bad. But for the most part, I don't need that. I don't need that. So it depends on the individual again, you know? So I hear what you're saying though.
Yeah. And thank you.
Thinking, you know, as we look to wind this down, I feel like you've done an amazing job helping us to think not only of like, what is this unique about this moment, right? With COVID and the dual pandemics of COVID and racism, kind of like taking us a little back into like what just the state was. Like, let's just be clear. COVID didn't mess up the world or the schools. Schools were already kind of messed up to begin with. And as we seek to leave our listeners or the board members with some thoughts about like, okay, what can the future look like? You know, we've talked about what not to do, right? Don't just throw any book, any manual at a bunch of teachers and say, hey, this is teaching in a book. It takes the art out. It makes it all hard and rigid. I want to think about like, what could we begin to see? What could it look like? And I just want to give an example. I haven't been in CF, Central Falls, Rhode Island in a while. But while I was still in Rhode Island, one of the things that I thought was one of the most exciting innovations that I saw that district throw out there was when they pivoted in the way they normally hired subs. And so instead of having subs come in like, oh, today I need someone, let me call Carla or let me call Doc. I think they called it the warrior teacher.
Equity warriors.
Yeah, yeah. And so the schools were hiring people who were full-time in the building, so that if and when a sub was needed, there were pre-existing relationships. Those professionals had already met the kids. They kind of knew context. And I don't know, like I said, that it's still going, but I thought of it like it changed the way I thought about substituting. And also it makes me think of, we wanted to take it to the next level. What if we treated roles like that, or created roles like that, to apprentice people into the teaching profession? I mean, I'm just riffing right now, but like, when you think about, you talked about it, like folks that have been in the game for a while and they have antiquated teacher preparation that doesn't reflect the current responsibilities or needs. What do you think about? Like, I know you're super creative. I mean, just so y'all know, like, there's some crazy virtual reality, amazing programming stuff that Carla and the Equity Institute are on. Like, they're just, I feel like, light years ahead of a lot of the game. But like, when you think about the future of teacher preparation and how we diversify the teaching force, what would you like to see us have? And like, what's our responsibility in getting to it?
Yeah, no, I think that that's, the apprenticeship is so important. And it's such a cool idea. Central Falls did a great job with that program. That program is still going on. But Central Falls is also just a you know, small town, and they're having a huge, sad to tell you this, but they're just having a huge issue with their budget and funding. We have
shout out to CF and the Warriors.
Shout out to CF, y'all. To Stephanie, especially Gonzalez.
Yes.
when we think about the future of teaching, you know, we're really right now, like, just observing and listening to what teachers are saying and listening to what, you know, how students are feeling. I mean, I have a 14-year-old who hates it right now, and he's like, I'm not learning anything. Like, why do I need this? Like, I can just learn with you, or I can, you know, learn by taking some other classes on my own. And so there's a lot of thoughts that I have based on that, on what we're seeing. But one thing we know for sure is this: we do not value our teachers enough, and we do not value this profession like it should be. And that is clear. We need to pay teachers more. So one thing that, you know, when I talk, and this might seem like very simple, but the future of teaching needs to be that we pay them more. We have to. If there are programs, apprenticeship programs, where you go and, you know, you learn a trade, like being a plumber, right? And you get out and you're making $100,000 a year. We need to be applying some other systems to teaching. So we need to get rid of certain barriers that exist, the length of time. It's so complicated to become a teacher, right? You have to study, you have to get your master's, you have to get your bachelor's, you have to take 29, well, maybe not 29, but lots of tests, right? Mm-hmm. And then you enter the profession making $38,000, right? You can only up your salary when you've been in the game for, you know, 10, 15 plus years. Okay, that needs to change. That needs to change because people have real lived experiences, and those need to apply to your level of competencies, right? I like how the Met and Big Picture Learning use real world learning to apply it to skills and to their grades. And I think we need to have a model like that, where it's like, we need to apply that to teachers. Right now we're running a program where we're taking teacher assistants and helping them get their bachelor's degree through College and Brown, which is run out of Rhode Island by the former founder of Big Picture Learning, Dennis Lickey, right? And if you talk to any of our fellows, they've all been in teaching as an assistant for 10 years, most of them, 5 years, some of them, right? And the reason they haven't become teachers is because either they don't have the time to go to school because they have a family they're raising, or they don't have the money to go to school, or they might have, like, you know, English might be their second language. Mm. Out of all of our fellows except one speak another language. We have Creole, Portuguese, and Spanish. They're all people of color except one. Imagine teacher prep programs like that, where all teacher prep programs are like that. They range from ages 22 to 55, right? They are a perfect example of what the system does, or does lack of what the system does, and why they're not teachers. Right. Yes. And so we're obviously doing something wrong here. If we have teacher shortages before COVID, and now we're going to have more because teachers, they can't. Many teachers don't know how to teach virtually and physically. Like, we need to change the way that we prepare our teachers and our teacher prep programs. Mm. It has to be a smoother way to get folks right on track with quality experiences, learning experiences with support, with mentorship, right? In our program, our fellows meet with our chief impact officer every week for 3 hours Wednesdays, every week they meet with them to keep them there. Because a lot of times we know that, you know, folks want to quit, you know, because they have all these things going on in their lives as well. So I think like thinking about how to redesign these teacher prep programs, how to redesign pathways, direct pathways from high school for students, get them on track. I mean, now that we're virtually online, I mean, we could get students to start taking classes in their senior year.
Anytime.
To become teachers, you know? Mm-hmm. So we have to be, I think we have to be really innovative, and we really need to think about all the layers, added layers of processes that we've placed on teachers when it just doesn't make sense, right?
Yeah.
We don't compensate them for that. And I know here in Rhode Island, we've talking with, you know, the Rhode Island Department of Education on how to forgo our fellows from taking the praxis. It just doesn't make sense. If they've been in the classroom for 10 plus years, why are they taking the praxis?
Right.
It doesn't add up. And so it's about talking to those people in power who are mostly, you know, older white people, and getting them on board to listen, because we have a huge, huge problem.
Yep.
And so it's going to take people like us, like you, Jonathan, like myself, like Doc supporting, to really, you know, be vocal, to think about these new ways and supporting the work that we're doing. So, you know, we're piloting this program here. We think this program is something that can go national in all different cities on how to get TAs into the classrooms. And so we're excited about that, and we're pushing for that, because we're advocating for those who have been historically marginalized and underserved, and we want to get them into classrooms. They're already there. They want
that's so dope.
Right.
You know, I mean, you said it, you talked about it earlier. You talked about white supremacy culture, right? This idea that one of the elements, that idea that there's one way, one right way, right? We have one right way, which requires, you know, 6 years of study, you know, undergrad plus master's, whatever, umpteen tests, you know, all these other hurdles. And we also recognize that very little of that directly correlates to performance, right? That's not the factor, right? And so what is the factor? You know, and also the fact that this is, or idea that this is not it's not a Rhode Island problem. It's not a Providence or CF problem. When you described what your TAs look like and your fellows look like, that sounded like my colleagues on the reservation.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my TAs who were banging, by the way, who were like, knew the kids, could like had their parents on speed dial because that's my auntie, my cousin, whatever, right?
Sure, yeah, that's right.
They were all right from the neighborhood. And it was because they have their own families and they can't fully devote to education, or they're struggling. They're stuck on it. You know, I can't tell you how many people I've done everything but pass the praxis. Like, really? Really?
Yeah.
That's the thing that's holding you up, because you have amazing rapport and content knowledge. So I just think like what you're saying is powerful. And it's a call to us, right? Like, don't just accept, we cannot just accept that because this is the way that it always was, it's the way it always has to be. We each have a role.
Yeah, I took the praxis like 8 times for math. So shout out to Carlin Howard, my co-founder and chief impact officer and partner in life. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have passed the praxis. I took it 8 times. You don't know what that did to my self-esteem. And I knew I was a good teacher, and it cost me lots of money. And you know what he told me, you know, when he was helping me learn and help me develop skills to take the test. He's like, you know, this is a test. You have to know how to test well. And testing well means eliminating the answers that you know are wrong, because it's going to be one that's going to try to trick you. And I'm like, what? Who would do that? That makes no, you know, I want to swear, but I won't. That makes no
sense. You got a button.
Like, all right, that makes no fucking sense. It's fucking ludicrous, right? Like, you're telling me I'm taking a test right now that's trying to fucking trick me? What the hell? I mean, and it even goes against my culture. Like, we're honest people. Why? We wouldn't do that to people, like, in order to measure their intelligence. So to measure my intelligence, you're trying to trick me?
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like some shady stuff. I don't know. I'm like, no. And then he told me, if you don't know the answer, choose C. And guess what I did? I chose C on the 8th time that I took it. When I chose C and I didn't know the answer, I passed.
To add insult to injury too, there's no evidence that the result of that test indicates anything. How you're going to be a teacher, right? Like, it doesn't even, like, you followed the map, you landed on the X. Oh, look, it's a Q, right? Like it's nothing yes. to do with other.
Yeah, so. No, right, right. And it's ridiculous, ridiculous. Mm. Like, I need a campaign against all kinds of testing for certification. Yes. Now, like I said, if it's competency-based, like if you're coming and observing and actually evaluating my skills, that's different, right? And so I think I'm not against having evaluation tools. I think we should. We should hold ourselves accountable. We should definitely be measuring ourselves to some degree. But the testing part, no. I'm definitely against that.
Well, I, for one, thank you. As a former teacher for more years than I care to share. And remembering that, I think the next generation of teachers are going to benefit from great thinkers and great ideas. And ultimately, the whole point is to serve kids. Our kids That's are going to get better teachers when we remove these barriers and provide them with the teachers that they deserve. Jonathan, you want to take us home for our very special, I guess, is this season 1.5?
This is, I don't know. I'm thinking about it. We're going to have to, put a flag on it. You know, it's the bonus, right? We saved some of the best for last. I just think, like, you know, you've been with us on this ride all season, and there's more to come, you know. That's why we had to have Carla on to give you something extra. First of all, shout out and appreciation to you, Carla, for being on the show, making the time.
Shout out to you.
After what you know, just navigating your family through your own personal COVID scare, right? Like, I think that's a reminder for us. Anyone who might be out there thinking like, this ain't that serious, you know, don't let your guard down. We got to still, because the powers that be in many cases are not looking out for us. We got to look out for ourselves and each other.
Absolutely.
Do the safe things. And that extends beyond the virus. It extends to school. Those of us that are in the work, outside of the work, you got kids in schools, your kids are graduated. We got to be together on this, right? We got to be committed to this, to transformation. Who gets to be in the classroom? Who gets the privilege of teaching our kids? What are the pathways that make it more diverse and more reflective? Like, we need to be committed and we need to care about that.
That's
great. Also, you know, this has been a real great throwback episode for me, showing love to a lot of my friends and familia back in Rhode Island. Shout out to Stephanie, who's I know is a listener. Shout out to the, like I said, the CF Warriors. Shout out to all the teachers in Providence who are holding it down amidst mad of heat upheaval. This system looks very different right now than it did when I was there 2.5 years ago. And y'all are still in the game. So we're grateful for you. And a special shout out to my, I said when this started to dock, if my mom and dad listened to the podcast, I'd be happy. I'm really grateful for my mom and dad that they do listen, but also to my pops, Angelo Garcia, Segway IFL, mad love to you, man. So appreciate you and the work you do in CF for all of the kids in Central Falls. So just want to dedicate this episode to all my family up in Rhode Island and Massachusetts area for riding with us this season. Yes, Rhode Island on our map, when we track our listens, is like dark red.
That's
y'all riding.
We're a small state, but we loud. We're loud, and we got big hearts. So don't sleep on us.
So whether you are in, you listen to us from Rhode Island, from Indiana, from Georgia, from the UK, India, Australia, South Africa, all our listeners, we've only just begun. Next season, we're gearing up to bring you more of what you grown to expect, and some surprises along the way.
If this was your first episode, remember that we are binge worthy. So go back to the website, theboardofed.com. That's the BOREDOFED.com. You can find us on Facebook, The Board of Ed, or on Twitter and Instagram at @_BoardOfEd. That's BORED. And you can find our episodes, this one, obviously, and any of the others on all the major podcast services out there. We thank you for joining us. We look forward to seeing you next season. And as always, stay bored. Yeah.